The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Sing this Negan. If you're sitting in an office at 1 o'clock in the afternoon in New York, and you start humming this nigga and your co-workers may get challenged. Just ignore them. This is a challenging evening because it kind of represents sort of the contrast. You know, while we're sitting here, I don't know if you've been following the news, but Israel once again took a step off the abyss last night, and large numbers of troops moved into Gaza, moved into the Gaza Strip. Right now, they're basically concentrating on the northern Gaza Strip. When you're in the army, you're up in Lebanon, you have a machine gun in your hands, you at least have the illusion that you have some modicum of control. And the truth is that, you know, up until that point, every experience I'd had, you know, I was young, I wasn't married, I didn't have children. You're out in Lebanon, it's a big adventure. You know, I'm not saying there weren't challenges, but at the end of the day, but then all of a sudden the war came home. In fact, I remember it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, January 15th, whatever it was, and my dad called me. And, or maybe it was 91, it was 1991 actually. And my dad called me, and he said, "Are you okay?" You know, and I was up studying for a rabbinical exam, and I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." He goes, "What, you didn't hear?" He goes, "The war started." I said, "What war? What are you talking about?" He goes, "They bombed Tel Aviv." I said, "Who bombed Tel Aviv?" He said, "Iraq is shooting Scud missiles at Tel Aviv." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I'm sitting here in Israel. If they had landed missiles in Tel Aviv, I would know. The air raid sirens would have gone off." So we're having this conversation. He says, "You sure you're okay?" He said, "I'm telling you, I'm watching this on CNN. It landed, it exploded, there's fire, there's firemen, I'm telling you, you're at war." I said, "Abba, I'm an officer, I'm in the army, I'm sitting here listening to the radio, there's no break-in for news. While I'm having this discussion, 10 minutes we're having this discussion, all of a sudden, beep, 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 it's a special report, Scud missiles just landed in Tel Aviv, everybody should now go to their, you know, sealed rooms." Right? "Abba, gotta go!" Right? I had to go wake up Dorit and wake up Mayan, you know. After that, we stopped listening to the news. We listened to CNN. And that was easier. And it was a very challenging experience. We had, you know, you had to seal the room. I don't know if you know the details of this, but you had to take plastic and, you know, gas, basically. It is lighter than air. So it rises. So you have to find a place that's as high up in your, wherever you are, as possible, because, you know, that's the safest place to be. And it was no longer about thick cement walls. It was about sealed rooms. Now, they didn't end up shooting gas. And in the end, you were safer in a bomb shelter. But we didn't know that. And 39 Scud missiles. And in fact, I remember they had these little, they were mamatim. They were like little cribs. They were gas chemical safe cribs. These little plastic boxes. And Mayan at the time was about 8 or 9 months old. And we ran in there. It was just Dorit and I in Mayan. And we had the sticker in this mamat, right? Because you can't put a gas mask on a 9-month-old, right? And there were like these little things with like, that you could put your fingers into black gloves so that you could move a toy around or like, you know, pat her head, whatever it might be, right? It's like, you know, you ever see those incubators with the black gloves, right, type of thing? Okay, so now you got to picture the scene. You're 9 months old. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, okay? The rule is, just like on an airplane, first you put your gas mask on, and then you worry about, you know, the child traveling with you, right? So Dorit and I have our gas masks on. I run into the, you know, the baby's room. I pick up Mayan, right? She wakes up at 2 in the morning. She sees a gas mask, right? Waking her up. Okay? I run out of the room. We go into the sealed room. And I put her inside this mamat and lock the door. Okay? So this is a nightmare, right? Like a monster just came to get you and put you in a cage. And then another monster comes to join you, happens to be Dorit, but she's also got a gas mask on, and the baby is in the mamat screaming her head off. And I'd never experienced this before. Now, eventually we learned the tricks, which is that you put bamba, it's like a little treat, you know, you put some chocolate and whatever it is in the thing, and then, you know, it works out, right? But we didn't know this. So you figure, okay, Nebuch, she's screaming, what do? So you put your finger in this hand, now the big black hand is trying to get her. So she's screaming hysterically. Now, what happens if your baby is screaming hysterically? What happens to your wife? She starts to cry. So she's crying, Nebuch. Right? Now, if you cry in a gas mask, you start to hyperventilate. So I'm trying to calm my wife down. The baby's screaming. You know, and it hit me. Like, we're at war. Scud missiles could fall any minute now. Right? This is a whole different level. And in that moment, you're thinking, like, you know, it just can't get any worse. And this is just, it's terrible. It's horrible. And I had never experienced that, because war is, you're in an army, you're out there, you're doing what you can do, you were totally helpless. And you were with your family, you had to watch them. The rear echelon became the front line. But the most amazing thing about this war was the 39 Scud missiles fell over a month period of time in the most heavily, densely populated areas in Israel, mostly in Gush Dan. And there was not one direct Scud hit casualty. Not one. In fact, I remember listening to the radio, and you know, every night there was this guy, Nachman Shine, who was supposed to keep you calm and really did an amazing job of telling us absolutely nothing but maybe making us feel good about it. And, you know, Scud has fallen. We can't say where. Don't worry. And if, you know, if you're okay, then you have nothing to worry about because there are no more coming and we'll keep you posted and thank you very much. And, you know, eventually you got to used to it. You know, you had to take your gas masks with you and kids took them to school. You know how it is, like the teenagers started decorating it, right? And people started rebelling by having purple gas masks, whatever it may be. But the stories, night after night, of the near misses. I remember there was this one story of this fellow, and he was in his apartment, and the siren went off. And it happened to be he had sent his family to wherever it was, you know, up in the Shomron. It was funny. Normally, you know, the people in the territories, so when things get bad, they get nervous, they go stay with their cousins in Tel Aviv. Here, all the cousins in Tel Aviv were coming to stay with us in the territories, because they were bombing Tel Aviv, right? So anyway, so he sent his, you know, kids to a safe place, you know, near Shomron, wherever it was, right near, I don't know, Ramallah. And, and you know, he's Nebuch in the front lines in Tel Aviv, right? And the siren goes off, but he had to go to the bathroom. So he's thinking, like, what should I do? Should I run to the protected sealed room? Or maybe I should run to the bomb shelter, but I have to go to the bathroom. So finally he says, you know what the heck with this? I'm going to the bathroom. So he goes and he sits in the bathroom, right? And a minute later, he hears this incredible explosion and dust flying and bricks flying. And when the dust clears and he opens his eyes, he's looking out, this is his description on the radio, at the skyline of Tel Aviv. Because the entire top floor of his apartment building has been blown away. And the only piece of the top floor of the building that's left is him sitting on his toilet. And he's interviewed by this guy because, you know, obviously they had to get him down. You know, Nebuch, I hope he pulled his pants up. But, you know, but you're like, all of a sudden, like, how do you get down? Like, Mommy, you know, what do you do? So they're interviewing him the next day on the news. And I remember he describes as, voila, ani, because, you know, I thought you go to the bathroom and it could be an explosive situation. I'm like, ze pitzutz, you know, was that right? And he says, pitom ani roet kulam. You know, I see everybody. But do you understand that night after night after night, it's like we didn't have a protective shield, right? So we had the protective shield. And we don't appreciate this. We don't appreciate it. They shot a Qassam missile at Ashkelon last night. It landed in the heart of Ashkelon, which is an Israeli city. It landed on a high school. These stories keep happening again and again in Sderot, all over the place. And by some miracle, nobody was there. And you know, you kind of wonder, how long is the merit of the Jewish people going to last? So they finally went in last night. And their whole battalions that are heading deep into Gaza, taking out terrorist cells. And I got to tell you, it's a very scary experience. You know, when we were doing this sort of stuff, more or less, at least in my regular army experience, you know, it was very clear. You were here, the enemy was there, you knew what you were looking to do. But now, it's like going into a hornet's nest. I want you to know that there are hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of Jewish families in Israel today that are not going to sleep well tonight because they know that their boys are deep in Gaza and they don't know, they have no contact with them, they're not allowed to use their cell phones. And they don't know if they're going to see them for Shabbat. And they don't know what the weekend will tell. So we should be with them, even if we're not with them. And I'll tell you the song that comes to mind, which some of us have discussed before. You know, Kol HaOlam Kulo, the whole world, is a very narrow bridge. It really is. It's a precarious bridge. The Ha'ikar and the main thing is Lo Lefachet Kalal, not to be afraid. Actually, Rav Nachman said Lo Lehit Pachet, not to let yourself become afraid. But that didn't work with the song, you know. And there are a lot of questions about that. The first question is, well, why is the world a narrow bridge? Why isn't the world a tall mountain? Why isn't the world a narrow river? You see, a bridge is never a place that you go to arrive at. A bridge is usually a place you're on in order to get somewhere. This world is not the goal. And sometimes we get so stuck thinking that this world is the goal that we forget that this world is just a vehicle to get us to the goal, to make the world a better place, to learn to give, to love, and to care. And that's really a fitting song to sing before Shabbat, because that's what Shabbat is all about, right? Shabbat is that opportunity to slow down, to be in the moment, to appreciate everything we've done all week, and to have a chance to think about, so why are we doing all this stuff? Well, what's the whole race about? You know? The second thing about that song that's strange is that the main thing is not to be afraid. What does that mean, the main thing is not to be afraid? I always thought the main thing is you're afraid. But, you know, you have to do what you have to do, right? That's courage. You're terrified, but you do what you have to do. Rav Nachman says, Rav Nachman of Breslov says, no, no, no. What is fear? See, fear is when you don't know. Right? Fear is when you don't know. You meet a girl, you think she's really cute, you want to ask her out. But you're afraid, because what if she disses you, right? But then you get married, you know, I'll go home, and, you know, tomorrow morning I'll tell my wife, let's go for a cup of coffee. I'm not afraid. She'll say yes, she'll say no, I'm not afraid, because I know she loves me, at least, you know, that was true this morning. And fear is when you don't know. If you could let go of not knowing, you would never be afraid. So it goes like this. Forget the words for the moment, let's just niggonize. If you're in New York and that sounded bad, it's not.
Yes, sir, Tom, yes, sir, Tom,
Doesn't get better than that. Okay. Now, people in America need drugs to do that. But not here. Here it's just a... Okay. If you don't know what we're talking about in America, that's probably a good thing. Okay. Powerful experience this year that some of us shared on the phone on Memorial Day. Memorial Day in Israel is very different from Memorial Day in America. In America, Memorial Day, there are two groups of Memorial Day in America. There is a very small number of people that have fought in America's wars and that still care, and you can usually see them on some televised ceremony with a lot of medals, you know, a bunch of old guys putting some wreaths on graves somewhere. And then you have the rest of America, which is about 98% of them, and it's basically party day. You know, it's like you're off in the office, you have a barbecue, maybe it's the Macy's sale, whatever it might be. And you just sense this tremendous disparity. And most people in America, they don't even realize what Memorial Day means. It just means there's a holiday. In Israel, it's very different. In Israel, Memorial Day is the eve of Independence Day. It'd be like July 3rd. And it's a very serious day. And the entire country basically packs the military cemeteries. There's a moment of silence at 11 o'clock in the morning, right? And the entire country stops. And I've experienced this in different places in Israel. One year I was with my army unit up in the Golan Heights. I've taken Israelite up to the Golan. I've been in Har Herzl a number of times. I've stood on the most crowded corner in Jerusalem on Jaffa Road and King George. Right? One year I was on my way to reserve duty and I totally forgot it was Memorial Day. And I was, this is way back, we were engaged and I had a motorcycle. And, I was riding along the highway and I just see all these cars are slowing down. So I'm passing them, whatever. It takes me a minute to ask, oh yeah, Memorial Day. Everybody in the highway, you can be on the Tel Aviv highway, they just stop, pull over, and everybody gets out of their car and stands at attention. Every radio, every television, everything just stops. And a siren goes for 2 minutes. And, to be on Har Herzl, Mount Herzl, with, 100,000 people. And everyone is there for the same reason. And everybody stops to take a moment. And the reason they do this on the eve of Memorial Day, right, on the eve of Independence Day, is because before we celebrate, you know, what a gift it is that we have this state, right? We first take a moment to appreciate what it took to get it, you know? And so went to Memorial Day, and I always had this struggle, because on the one hand, and you wouldn't get this, like I could say this on the phone, but now that you're here and you've experienced this week here in Israel learning, or you will one day, so you get what I'm talking about. Like imagine tomorrow morning it's Memorial Day and you could be sitting here learning, or you could go off to the military cemetery. That's a difficult question. To stop learning Torah in order to remember, maybe we should be learning Torah in order to remember, you know, all those who fell. On the other hand, how could you be sitting inside a study hall in the Beit Midrash, in the Old City, when the state of Israel is honoring her dead? You just can't do it. So what we do at Israelite is we do both. You know, we took a group this year, and we went to Har Herzl. Instead of getting there in time for the Sfar 11, we got there at 9, and I gave a class, I gave a shiur. We found a place on the side, and we sat there. We started out about, I don't know, 30 of us. Then there was a girls' school that came by and asked if they could join us, and then we had 60. And then there was another group that came. Before we knew it, we had, I don't know, 100, 150 people. I have no idea how many people were standing there. And then, you know, we kind of broke the class up, and we all sort of went in different directions. And some students came with me. I went up to the grave of a very close friend of mine who was killed in action in 1984. And he was a guy who took me under his wing, Danny Majid, Hashem Yikom Damo. And whenever I can, you know, on Memorial Day, I go up to his grave. And I hadn't been there on Memorial Day in a few years because I was in Florida. And there was a family there, and they were sitting by the grave next to Danny's, you know. And I got to talking to this woman who, you know, was next to his grave. And turned out that she was a Holocaust survivor. And her entire family was lost in the Holocaust. And this son of hers, who was killed in action, you know, I think 3 days before Danny, right, was really her tribute to those who fell. He was named after someone who was killed in the Holocaust. And she's sitting there in the chair, and she had the most incredible smile. And we're talking about it. And I sat there, like, she saw me standing there, and she saw that I was kind of losing it. So we got into this conversation. And this was like, she must be a 70-year-old woman, because her son was like almost 30 when he was, whatever it was, when he was killed. And this is in 1984, so, you know, she's getting on. And she had such a positive attitude. And it just blew my mind that a woman could go through all that, come to Israel, rebuild her family, right? Lose her son, be sitting at Mount Herzl, at a military cemetery, memorializing her son who died, never having married, with no children, and still be smiling. So I just had to ask her, because I knew if I didn't ask her, I'd wonder forever. So I asked her, I said, how do you, like, you seem to have such a positive attitude. How do you see the world through such positive lenses after everything you've been through? And she looked at me and she just waved her hand. I said, look, right, there's 100,000 people. Like, we made it. The state of Israel is born, and we're here. And it actually reminded me of an interesting story. I was once at a wedding. You know, it's a real challenge if you're Israeli to go to an American wedding. Okay? Because, you know, in Israel, right, what do? First of all, you don't know who the chassan is. You're not sure who the groom is, because everybody's wearing white shirts. The chatan's the one whose white kippah looks new. That's how you find him. Otherwise, you wouldn't know. And he's the one, hopefully, with a smile from ear to ear, right? If not, you got a problem, right? And you know, there's a chassan's tish, right? You know, the chatan, the groom, is at a table, and they're signing the ketubah, the marriage document, and all the guys come, and they're all dancing, singing. And then they dance into the bedekin. They dance into the unveiling, the veiling, really. That's a whole other discussion, where they veil the bride, right? And then they dance them off to the chuppah. And then they come back, and they dance the bride to the chuppah. And it's all a lot of energy. Right? And they're dancing him and they're dancing her, and then she walks around to him as a symbol of, you know, the love relationship between God and the Jewish people and the eternity of our bond and all this, and everybody's singing, and it's unbelievable. And you know, at Israeli weddings, for the most part, people stand. You know, they don't, this whole rows of seats, it doesn't, you know, so it's all this energy, right? But nobody talks. They don't talk. They just stand. And then I went to America for 3 years and I got a bit of a shock, you know? First of all, you don't dance them to the chuppah. No, no, no. You sit down, you're seated. And you have to know where to sit because they were reserved seats. And you're already feeling pretty good because you had the hors d'oeuvres. If you ever go to an Israeli wedding and you're waiting for the hors d'oeuvres, no, it really is just olives, right? And then there's the seat, and of course, you know, then there's the music. The music has to set the tone. And they're in the back somewhere arranging all the parties, but you don't know this, you don't understand what we're waiting for. Like, let's go, the couple wants to get married, we want to eat dinner, come on, right? No. And then they start coming out, and each person who walks down has a song. They have their song. And there's the friend of the groom, and the other friend of the groom, and there's the nieces of the groom who have to like throw petals, a chvesnish, and then there's the little kid who carries the ring, right? In my family, like I had a best man, he had the ring, and if he didn't show up with it, he was meat, and that was it. And then we didn't dance him down, he was there or else. And then there's, you know, the uncles and the aunts and the father and the bride, you know, and that's just the groom's party. And we start with the bride's party, we start all over again, you know? And you have like a whole bunch of girls who have to wear the same pink bubblegum dress that no one is ever going to wear again, right? And it has to match the tablecloth. So chlesnish. And you come to an American wedding, you're like, whoa, this is like crazy. But once at this wedding, and it just seemed to go on and on and on. I mean, every cousin and every, you know, nephew and every niece, and they're all marching down separately, whatever. And you look at this whole story, you don't get it. And I'm the rabbi, and I'm doing this chuppah, and I'm like getting a little impatient. Like, it's like a 40-minute chuppah. It's ridiculous, right? You know, I mean, the ice cream's melting already, right? So the grandmother of the groom noticed that I was like, you know, I cracked a joke to the chazan. They was there. They had a chazan, because how could you not have a chazan, right? A cantor. And, you know, a couple of times I looked at my watch, whatever, you know, because, like, everybody else was in the moment, and I wasn't, to be honest, and I wasn't good. So afterwards, like after the whole chuppah, and you know, once we got to the chuppah, it was great, and it was wonderful. So after the whole chuppah, she came over and she said, you don't get it. You're probably wondering why that was such a long, you know, ceremony. I said, well, yeah, you mentioned that. That's pretty much the longest ceremony I've ever been at. You know? And I said, you know, in Israel, like if you did that in Israel, they'd shoot you. You know, and there are guys in the audience with machine guns who can do it. You know, we don't have Sundays. We don't have time for this stuff. So she said to me, she said, you know, she said, 60 years ago, as a girl, I watched my parents shot in front of me. We're at her grandson's wedding. She's telling me this. I watched my parents shot in front of my eyes. And I lost my parents, and I had 9 brothers and sisters. Every single one of them was killed. You know? And I lost pretty much all my relatives. I had no one left. You know? And when I finished the war, I was broken. And actually, an American soldier met me, and we got married, and we eventually, you know, and now, and she says to me, look around you. So I have 34 grandchildren. 34 grandchildren. She says, and every single one of them walked by. And she looks at me, she goes, that's Reuven. He's named after my uncle. And that's Yosef. He's named after my cousin. She said, every single person who walked back down that chuppah is my revenge against the Nazis. Is my response. And so at every simcha, the family knows that everyone walks down. I've never looked at a chuppah the same way again. Such a wise woman. You know, we don't know what we're looking at in this world. We think we do, but we don't. So we've been through a tough time. And it sounds like we're going to have some more tough times ahead. But you know, it shouldn't get you down, because it's like birth. You know? It shouldn't get the men down, because you don't have to go there. But you know, birth pangs are challenging. But God willing, they bring life into the world. So even though we don't get it, and anybody who thinks you get it in this world, I don't get it. But we can at least hope that whatever challenges lie ahead, that they lead to good things. New things being born and redemption and peace. So this is a niggun that we learned together this week. Ooh, but I think we have to change the capo. I think I might be wrong. On 3. Yeah. Ooh. Hey, Anna. Na 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 na
na na na na na na na.
This moment that you hit on Thursday afternoon, and it hits you really Thursday night, you know? Like, there's nowhere you're running to. You know, we spend all this time and all this energy struggling between where we are, and where we have to get to, where we came from, and whether we're in the right place. And every once in a while, you just get to a moment in your life but there's just nowhere else to go but right here. You know, my kids are, one of the challenges at the beginning of the summer is, okay, so which kid is going to which summer camp and how's that going to work out? And I don't know what it's like in America, but in Israel, even just in our neighborhood area in Gush Etzion and Efrat, we get bombarded with so many different, you can go to karate camp or baseball camp or basketball camp or, you know, there are camps of learning in the morning and swimming in the afternoon or swimming in the morning and learning in the afternoon or, you know, you can do double camps, you can do the home, you know, sort of in the bomb shelter, kids in the neighborhood camp, which is really cheap and you get what you pay for, or you can go all the way out, you know, and you kind of struggle with this, right? And eventually, you know, you figure it all out and, you know, which, that's the royal you, it really means my wife, and you know, you get into the zone. And, you know, with school, you put an enormous amount of energy into, like, well, who are the teachers, and where are they going, and what did they learn today, and what's your homework for tomorrow? So you get very involved in the day-to-day. But summer camp, you know, what'd you do today? I played ball and I swam. That's great, honey. You know, like, you kind of fall out of that zone, and that's healthy to a certain degree. Like, your kids can just be. They don't have to be becoming, you know? But it's also a mistake, because on a certain level, at least I can speak for myself, kids learn much more in summer camp than they do all year round. What they accomplish, in Jewish camps at least, what they learn in the summer, when they're not in school, and when their role models are playing ball with them, in an hour of learning a day, or 2 hours a day, is usually light years beyond what they can learn in 8 hours in school. So, you know, you put a lot of thought into it. And so this week, I've been, waking up early, and, you know, two of my kids are going to summer camp in Yerushalayim. But in order to get in time to teach a 9 o'clock class, so we have like big traffic that comes from Friday. If you leave at 8 o'clock, you're never going to get here by 9. So I've been taking this like 7 a.m. class. So we figured out if I'm taking a 7 a.m. cab to Yerushalayim, so I'll take, you know, either one or both of the kids and I'll drop them off at their camps and then I'll figure out a way to get to Israel, right? So on Wednesday morning, yesterday morning, it just worked out that I was taking Adi. Adi is just turned 10. It's big, right? This is the double-digit birth thing. You know, a few days ago she turned 10, and, you know, this is big. In fact, tonight she had a birthday party, but we decided, you know, largely because I had to be here, that it was going to be just girls. It was for the ladies. Men are not allowed, right? Just the chicks hanging out. And my wife's older in this, and, you know, because we had our own family party with her, and she loved the idea. She was so excited. We took Yair away, and he went to sleep over at his cousin's house, and so it's just the girls. Unbelievable, right? And I got away with it. And so yesterday morning, I took a cab in with her. And, you know, we're in the cab, and I'm thinking, like, you know, am I going to hit traffic? Am I going to get there? And about 5 minutes into the cab ride, this, like, mental switch took over. I just realized, like, I'm riding with my 10-year-old daughter in the back of a cab. It's just the two of us, right? And this is like 20 minutes of gold. And we had the most incredible conversation, you know? And you don't usually get to have those conversations. And I think that is the energy of Shabbat, you know? You know, we sit here, and we're a group, right? I mean, there's 30 of us, 40 of us, whatever it is. And we're all learning the same material, but we're not really learning the same material. Because we're receiving it in totally different ways, all of us. Right? And lots of people here are having totally different experiences. And because of the nature of this program, and because you're not all, you know, 23 staying in the same dorm, so you don't get to be with each other as much until Shabbat. And come Shabbat, you know, you get a chance to just be with who you're with. And don't make the mistake, by the way, of showing up to Friday night dinner tomorrow night, you know, Kabbalat Shabbat, wherever it is. I mean, it's an unbelievable experience. To experience Kabbalat Shabbat, receiving Shabbat. You know, there's no other service in the Jewish calendar that's a Kabbalah service. There's no Kabbalat Rosh Hashanah. There's no Kabbalat Yom Kippur. Only Kabbalat Shabbat. Because that's what Shabbat is all about. Shabbat is all about receiving. It's about learning to let things in, you know, and to let go. And you sit down to dinner, and sometimes people come here, they're in the zone of, like, you know, okay, when is Rabbi Aaron going to speak? When are we going to do it? When are we going to have the event? And you don't realize there's no event. The event is just being together and singing together and being at the Shabbat table together. You know? And I challenge you. I challenge you over Shabbat to just be in every single moment. You know, so few people in this world who get the merit to experience Shabbat. And there's so few people who get to experience it in Israel. And there's so few people who get to experience it in Israel this Shabbat. And there's so few people who get to experience Shabbat in Israel, in the old city of Yerushalayim. Not like you're going to experience it. That's a very special thing. I mean, maybe it's a dangerous thing to say, but I don't think there's anybody else in the world who's going to have the experience on Shabbat that you're going to have this Shabbat. Of course, that's true of everybody everywhere at the Shabbat, when you think about it. But you know, you will never have the Shabbat again. Hopefully you will have many other Shabbatot, but you'll never have this Shabbat. So don't wait until tomorrow afternoon to start thinking about that. Prepare yourself to appreciate whatever it is you want to appreciate, whatever it is you want to do with the Shabbat. Teacher Niggin. This is an amazing Niggin. Maybe you know this Niggin. We'll have to change the thing again. Sorry. So the words of this song are Tov Lo Dot. It's just good to be thankful. So much to be thankful for. So it goes like this. I happen to be one of the world experts at breaking moods. It's a gift I have. So it goes like this. Try that, ready? Then it goes like this. Try that. Then it goes like this. Ay, na, 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 na,
Shimcha Elia.
Second verse goes like this.
Lashen,
Wondering what it's like to be sitting in a New York office. Somebody walks into your office and the speakerphone's on and some guy's singing into your phone. So you're working hard there, huh, pal? Walk out of here in a little while, take a deep smell. You'll smell challah's baking, you'll smell chickens in the oven, you'll smell, you know, meat cooking, chilling, getting ready, all these unbelievable smells that float around the old city. And then you'll go to town and you'll eat, because you'll need to. So I had a battalion commander who, he was a short little guy, wiry, but just an incredible force of will. He was my battalion commander when I was in officer's course. And he was an incredible individual, right? He lived in a kibbutz up in the Golan Heights. It wasn't the Ganya, I forget the name of it. And he took us up to the Golan one year on Memorial Day, basically to the memorial of the 188th Battalion, Brigade, sorry, was basically completely wiped out in the Yom Kippur War. They were one of two brigades that held the line in the Yom Kippur War. And it is safe to say, without obviously, you know, the hidden secret weapon, our commander-in-chief, but putting that aside, at least on this earth, without these boys, we wouldn't have stayed today. I mean, it was that close. There were 2,000 Syrian tanks across the border on 2 o'clock in the afternoon of Yom Kippur. There was only one battalion, about 25 tanks, that was actually on the ready, you know, with their tanks under camouflage nets. That was the 77th. And these two brigades, you're talking about a total of maybe 150 tanks, all across the Golan had to hold off 2,000 Syrian tanks. Anyways, he took us up there. It was the most unique Memorial Day I've ever had. It was totally different from anything else I had ever and since ever have experienced. Because there was no one else there. It was just us. We were in the middle of a valley on the Golan Heights. And just the wind. And an entire battalion of cadets who were in officer training. Who were, you know, a couple months away from becoming officers in the Israeli Army. In the tank corps. And here we were on Memorial Day, standing with our battalion commander, telling us how, you know, 20 years earlier, 10 years earlier, we had almost lost the state of Israel. And a handful of men in a handful of tanks had turned the tide. So you can imagine that's a powerful experience. And there's one story that stuck out in my mind. When we got to officer's course, there are different types of tanks, okay? And, you know, in order to train men to be in armored battalions all over the Israeli army, you have to bring them to officer's course, but you can't start training them how to work on a new tank. So it's the only battalion in it's one of two, sergeant's course and officer's course, that's made up of different tanks. Okay, there's a battalion of Pattons, there's a battalion of Merkavot, there are Centurionim Shotim, which were centurions, which were British-made tanks, and they all work together, God forbid, in a war, and they become a brigade. He told us that when he was in the Yom Kippur War, he was a driver. And he was actually down in the Suez Canal initially, and then eventually made his way up to the Golan, or vice versa, I don't remember. And he was in a tank. And the thing about the centurion tank, you know, the driver sits in a compartment that's separate from the rest of the crew. Think about a tank, and there's a turret on the tank. The turret has to rotate, which means that the inside of the turret, the floor of the turret, inside the sort of body of the tank, has to rotate, right? So that obviously has to be separate from the driver, because if the driver's rotating, you know, he can't drive, right? So he's in this box, driving straight, and the crew is turning round and round, you know, sort of following the gun, right? So that means you need a separate compartment, and you need a separate door. And the Centurion, which is an older tank, so in order to protect the driver, because the driver's very vulnerable, because he's in the front of the tank, and he's going to hit first, they have extra armor around the driver's compartment, and the doors that are on top of the driver's compartment, so in American-made tanks, and Israeli tanks, you know, have perfected this, there's a hatch that you open that slides. So it's easier, right? But in the Centurion tanks, there were two hatches, one on top of the other. They were made of iron, okay? And you had to open them like this. And you had to, it was very hard to open them. Even if you pull the latch open, to push them open, they're incredibly heavy. And basically, it was impossible to open them on your own. So what would happen is, one of the crew members would jump down when you stopped the tank, and he would get on top, and he would pull, and you would push, and that's how you get them open, and you get out. And that was the drill. And the only problem with this drill is what happens in a war. You know, what happens if there's no crew? What happens if the crew gets hit and you need to get out? So that's exactly what happened to Gadi. He was in his tank, he was a driver, and his tank got hit by an anti-tank shell. And the tank was on fire. And when the tank's on fire and you're sitting on top of, 52 tons, including 2 tons worth of armaments, right? So it could blow any minute. So, a couple of the crew members were killed, and one of the crew members was thrown off the tank. And he's basically left in a burning tank, and he's screaming because he can, the fire's all around him, and he's stuck in the driver's turret. By some miracle, right? Either he will never know because the commander of the tank realized that if he didn't do this, his driver would be killed, or by some intervention of fate, it happened to be that way. The turret was in such a way that you could get out of the driver's compartment. If the turret is facing forward, you can't get out of the driver's compartment. It's underneath the gun. So he's sitting in it now. He knows that now. But he didn't know that then. He didn't know if he'd even get out. And he's screaming and he's yelling. Of course, nobody's there. Nobody can help him. So he has to get out of the tank. But you can't get out of the tank if you're driving a Centurion tank. So he's pushing the door, and he can't push the door anymore, and it's not working. So thank God he was a small guy. So he succeeds. And he has to understand a tank turret. It's like, I was a tank driver when I started. And, you're basically sitting on this low chair about yay low to the floor. And this is the entire size of the compartment that you're in. Okay? Like, this is already the turret. You couldn't sit like this. It's basically the roof is here. You're in a compartment that's this big. And you have to get used to this. I mean, you can be in there the longest nonstop time that I was ever in a tank in the driver's compartment. You can imagine how this motivated me to become an officer so I get to be outside the turret. It was a 14-hour targil. We were in a maneuver. It was 14 hours straight. I was in this turret. When I came out, I was so drenched from the heat of being in the tank that my uniform was dark. It was completely drenched. You could literally wring sweat out of my uniform. So he's in this space. So he manages to maneuver himself so that his feet are now up in the air, and he's on his back. And he manages to get his feet up against the doors. The handle's been opened. And with all his might, he pushes, and he succeeds in throwing the doors open because he's in a panic. And he manages to get out of the tank, and he gets out of the tank, and literally, he says he jumps out of the tank, and as he's in the air jumping off the tank, right, the tank explodes. And he lands not quite where he planned. Well, one thing went to another, and he made it through the war. And after the war, he tried this a number of times. And he was never able again to do this. And he still doesn't know how he did it. So he issued a challenge to all of the men in the battalion. He said, obviously, officers is an honor system, right? He said, if you can get into a Centurion tank, and there were some Centurions that were parked out down, on the tank lot. I was in a Patton. If you can do this, You can get on your back, and with your legs, you can open the driver's compartment of a Centurion tank. I will give you a weekend pass. All you have to do is come to me on Friday morning. I did it. Bring with you another cadet who says I saw it, and I will give you a weekend pass. Just like that. Now, you don't understand. A weekend pass in the Army, Nachin Officer's Course, I mean, there are no words to describe that. That's like a taste of the world to come. That's just that you can't imagine a greater reward than that. So every Thursday afternoon when we came back from maneuvers and we were, working on our tanks, you could always see a bunch of guys down by the Centurion tanks, desperately trying to kick open these things. I tried this myself 4 or 5 times, almost pulled my back doing it, I finally gave up. Not a single guy in the entire battalion ever succeeded in doing this. And at the end of the course, when everybody was about to graduate, like 3 days before the end of the course, he gathered us all together for what's called a Sichat Motivatsiya, Sichat Sikuma, a sort of a concluding the course and a motivational speech, you're about to go out to be officers. And he asked us, he said, so did anybody here succeed? Of course, nobody had succeeded, and he knew that. He said, I want you to know that I knew that nobody here would succeed. And guys laughed. So he said, let me ask you a question. How much time do you think this battalion collectively wasted down on the Centurion tanks, trying to open up those turrets? So everybody was thinking whatever. He said, trust me, it's a lot of time. So why do you think I wasted your time? And he said something which has stuck with me since. He says, because there's logic, and then there's soul. Yishigayon v'yish neshama. He said, there's some things in the world you can't do with logic. They have to come from the heart. He says, there's certain times in your life where in order for something to happen, you have to will it to happen. And if you will it enough, if you desire it enough, if you absolutely have to do it, you'll do it because you have to do it. That's the only way I got out of that tank, he said, because I had to get out of that tank. Of course, I guess the question is we have to figure out what it is that we know we have to do. This is a song for Shabbat. It's interesting that on Shabbat morning in the prayer service, it says, V'shnei luchot avanim horid biyado. Moshe brought down 2 tablets, right? And in those tablets it was written about Shabbat, right? V'chen katuv b'toratecha, and so it said, right? So now if you were going to quote from the Torah about Shabbat, and it's getting late, so this will be our last niggun for the night, because I want you to have energy for Shabbat tomorrow night. The truth is, I don't want to let you out at midnight and have you miss the experience of being in your Shalayim on Thursday night, because that's also worth experiencing. So we're trying to find balance here. Plus, I promised my wife. And but one last niggun. It says Moshe brought down these 2 tablets, and in those 2 tablets it speaks about Shabbat, right? Now, what would you quote if you're quoting Shabbat from the 2 tablets? So it says, and so it says in your Torah. So I would have thought that it would have said, right, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, remember Shabbat. Or Shamor et Yom HaShabbat, keep the Shabbat, because that's what the language of the Ten Commandments is, but that's not what it says. It says, V'chein katuv, and so it says, V'shamru b'nei Yisrael et HaShabbat. And the Jewish people kept Shabbat. Right? La'asot et HaShabbat, to make Shabbat. So 2 questions I have on that verse. First of all, what is so important about they kept Shabbat, V'shamru b'nei Yisrael et HaShabbat? So I want you to understand that Shmirat Shabbat is not really guarding. It's not just keeping Shabbat. It's a whole different level. In Israel, if you want to tell something that somebody's really important to you, something's really important to you, I'm here tonight, and maybe Yair was here, and he's 7 years old, and somebody here's going back to Efrat. So I put him in the car with you so you can take him back to Efrat, and I say to you, listen, I'll be Shmor alav. Take good care of him. Cherish him. It's my most precious possession. So v'shamru doesn't mean they guarded it. It means they cherished it. It means it was important to them. They valued it. And then it's interesting that it says that they kept Shabbat, they cherished Shabbat. La'asot et haShabbat, to make the Shabbat. What does that mean? That's not grammatically logical. So Shabbat ultimately is what you make of it. You see, in the Ten Commandments, it just talks about the mitzvah we were getting. But in this section, in the portion of Ki Tisa, it talks about what we did with the Shabbat that we got. And that's what's really meaningful. You see, the first stage is to think about what it is that God gives us. But then comes the question, so what do we do with that? You know, the big challenge of this program, of this week, of an inward bound of learning, or of a telephone call if anybody's still out there, right? The big challenge is not what you get. It's not what you're getting this week. That's no big deal. You know, people come over to you afterwards. Oh, that was an amazing program. Come on. You're sitting in a 900-year-old Crusader building in the old city of Jerusalem, playing guitars. How could you not have an amazing experience? You'd have to be an idiot to give people a bad experience in a place like this. I'm being serious, right? Or you'd have to be an idiot not to come, right? But the real question is what you do with it. What do you do with this? Do you take this with you? You know? So that's the Shamru. Shamru is that we shouldn't just come to experience the Shabbat. We should experience the Shabbat, revel in the Shabbat, and figure out a way to hang on to it so we can take it with us into next Shabbat, and next Shabbat, and next Shabbat. So it goes like this. The problem with this niggun is you can't stop it. So it should be like Shabbos that just never ends. At Israelite, you'll see that that's a little bit true. And I wanna just tell you what an absolute privilege and pleasure it's been learning with you all this week, studying together. And you know, I'm not gonna be with you for Shabbat, but I will be with you for Shabbat. But I'm looking forward to seeing you again, Mitzvah Shem, Sunday morning. And I just want to warn everybody, the problem when you experience an Israelite Shabbat, that you change. And what happens is you don't realize it. So you'll come back Sunday morning, you won't walk and you'll be floating. So that's a very low archway. So just be very careful when you float back in on Sunday morning. I wish everybody a wonderful Shabbos. I don't know if anybody's still there.
Conversation mode is on.
I gotta know.
Everyone can now be heard.
Is anybody still there?
Yes!
Oh my God. Woo! That is unbelievable. Wow. Alright, well, we wish you all an incredible Shabbos. Next week, same time, same bat channel, 1 p.m. in America, 8 p.m. in Israel. Where you are for that call is up to you. All right, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Shabbat Shalom. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.